Chapter 7. Business seemed to him an undesirable helper. That the boat had been lowered to communicate with the cross scene and avoided by him in the evening, he had no doubt. The thought had flashed on him at once. It had an ugly look. Yet the best thing to do after all was to hang on and get back to the yacht and warn them. Warn them against whom? The man had been perfectly open with him. Warn them against what? It struck him that he hadn't the slightest conception of what would happen, of what was even likely to happen. That strange rescuer himself was bringing the news of danger. Danger from the natives, of course. And yet he was in communication with those natives. That was evident. That boat going off in the night. Carter swore heartily to himself. His perplexity became positive bodily pain as he sat, wet, uncomfortable, and still, one hand on the tiller, thrown up and down in headlong swings of his boat. And before his eyes, towering high, the black hull of the brig also rose and fell, setting her stern down in the sea, now and again, with a tremendous and foaming splash. Not a sound from her reached Carter's ears. She seemed an abandoned craft, but for the outline of a man's head and body still visible in a watchful attitude above the taffrail. Carter told his bowman to haul up closer and hailed. "Brig ahoy! Anything wrong?" He waited, listening. The shadowy man still watched. After some time a curt "Oh" came back in answer. "Are you going to keep hove too long?" shouted Carter. "Don't know. Not long. Drop your boat clear of the ship. Drop clear. Do damage if you don't." "Slack away, John," said Carter in a resigned tone to the elderly seaman in the bow. "Slack away, and let us ride easy to the full scope. They don't seem very talkative on board there." Even while he was speaking the line ran out, and the regular undulations of the passing seas drove the boat away from the brig. Carter turned a little in his seat, to look at the land. It loomed up dead, to leeward like a lofty and irregular cone only a mile, or a mile and a half distant. The noise of the surf beating upon its base was heard against the wind in measured detonations. The fatigue of many days spent in the boat asserted itself above the restlessness of Carter's thoughts, and, gradually, he lost the notion of the passing time without altogether losing the consciousness of his situation. In the intervals of that benumbed stupor, rather than sleep, he was aware that the interrupted noise of the surf had grown into a continuous great rumble, swelling periodically into a loud roar, that the high islet appeared now bigger, and that a white fringe of foam was visible at its feet. Still there was no stir or movement of any kind on board the brig. He noticed that the wind was moderating, and the sea going down with it, and then dozed off again for a minute. When next he opened his eyes with a start, it was just in time to see with surprise a new star soar noiselessly straight up from behind the land, take up its position in a brilliant constellation, and go out suddenly. Two more followed, ascending together, and after reaching about the same elevation, expired side by side. "Them's rockets, sir, ain't they?" said one of the men in a muffled voice. "Aye, rockets," grunted Carter. "And now, what's the next move?" he muttered to himself dismally. He got his answer in the fierce swishing whir of a slender ray of fire that, shooting violently upward from the somber hull of the brig, dissolved at once into a dull red shower of falling sparks. Only one, white and brilliant, remained alone poised high overhead, and after glowing vividly for a second, exploded with a feeble report. Almost at the same time he saw the brig's head fall off the wind, made out the yard swinging round to fill the main topsail, and heard distinctly the thud of the first wave thrown off by the advancing bows. The next minute the tow line got the strain, and his boat started hurriedly after the brig with a sudden jerk. Leaning forward, wide awake and attentive, Carter steered. His men sat one behind another with shoulders up, and arched backs, dozing, uncomfortable but patient, upon the thwarts. the care requisite to steer the boat properly in the track of the seething, undisturbed water left by the brig in her rapid course prevented him from reflecting much upon the incertitude of the future, and upon his own unusual situation. Now he was only exceedingly anxious to see the yacht again, and it was with a feeling of very real satisfaction that he saw all plain sail being made on the brig. Through the remaining hours of the night he sat grasping the tiller, and keeping his eyes on the shadowy and high pyramid of canvas gliding steadily ahead of his boat with a slight balancing movement from side to side. It was noon before the brig, piloted by Lingard through the deep channels between the outer coral reefs, rounded within pistol shot a low hummock of sand which marked the end of a long stretch of stony ledges that, being mostly awash, showed a black head only, here and there amongst the hissing brown froth of the yellow sea. As the brig drew clear of the sandy patch there appeared, dead to windward, and beyond a maze of broken water, sand spits, and clusters of rocks, the black hull of the yacht heeling over, high and motionless upon the great expanse of glittering shallows. Her long, naked spars were inclined slightly, as if she had been sailing with a good breeze. There was to the lookers on aboard the brig something sad and disappointing in the yacht's aspect as she lay perfectly still in an attitude that in a seaman's mind is associated with the idea of rapid motion. "Here she is," said Shaw, who, clad in a spotless white suit, came just then from forward, where he had been busy with the anchors. "She is well on, sir, isn't she? Looks like a mudflat to me from here." "Yes, it is a mudflat," said Lingard, slowly, raising the long glass to his eye. "Haul the mainsail up, Mr. Shaw," he went on while he took a steady look at the yacht. "We will have to work in short tacks here." He put the glass down and moved away from the rail. For the next hour he handled his little vessel in the intricate and narrow channel with careless certitude, as if every stone, every grain of sand upon the treacherous bottom had been plainly disclosed to his sight. He handled her in the fitful and unsteady breeze with a matter-of-fact audacity that made Shaw, forward at his station, gasp in sheer alarm. When heading toward the inshore shoals the brig was never put round till the quick loud cries of the leadsman announced that there were no more than 3 feet of water under her keel, and when standing toward the steep inner edge of the long reef, where the lead was of no use, the helm would be put down, only when the cutwater touched the faint line of the bordering foam. Lingard's love for his brig was a man's love, and was so great that it could never be appeased unless he called on her to put forth all her qualities and her power to repay his exacting affection by a faithfulness tried to the very utmost limit of endurance. Every flutter of the sails flew down from aloft along the taut leeches to enter his heart in a sense of acute delight, and the gentle murmur of water alongside, which, continuous and soft, showed that in all her windings his incomparable craft had never, even for an instant, ceased to carry her way, was to him more precious and inspiring than the soft whisper of tender words would have been to another man. It was in such moments that he lived intensely, in a flush of strong feeling that made him long to press his little vessel to his breast. She was his perfect world full of trustful joy. The people on board the yacht, who watched eagerly the first sail they had seen since they had been ashore on that deserted part of the coast, soon made her out, with some disappointment, to be a small merchant brig beating up tack for tack along the inner edge of the reef, probably with the intention to communicate and offer assistance. The general opinion among the seafaring portion of her crew was that little effective assistance could be expected from a vessel of that description. Only the sailing master of the yacht remarked to the boatswain, who had the advantage of being his first cousin, "This man is well acquainted here. You can see that by the way he handles his brig. I shan't be sorry to have somebody to stand by us. Can't tell when we will get off this mud, George." A longboard, sailed very close, enabled the brig to fetch the southern limit of discolored water over the bank on which the yacht had stranded. On the very edge of the muddy patch she was put in stays for the last time. As soon as SE had paid off on the other tack, sail was shortened smartly, and the brig commenced the stretch that was to bring her to her anchorage, under her topsails, lower staysails and jib. There was then less than a quarter of a mile of shallow water between her and the yacht, but while that vessel had gone ashore with her head to the eastward, the brig was moving slowly in a west-northwest direction, and consequently, sailed, so to speak, past the whole length of the yacht. Lingard saw every soul in the schooner on deck, watching his advent in a silence which was as unbroken and perfect as that on board his own vessel. A little man with a red face framed in white whiskers waved a gold-laced cap above the rail in the waist of the yacht. Lingard raised his arm in return. Further aft, under the white awnings, he could see two men and a woman. One of the men and the lady were in blue. The other man, who seemed very tall, and stood with his arm entwined round an awning stanchion above his head, was clad in white. Lingard saw them plainly. They looked at the brig through binoculars, turned their faces to one another, moved their lips, seemed surprised. A large dog put his forepaws on the rail, and, lifting up his big, black head, sent out three loud and plaintive barks, then dropped down out of sight. A sudden stir and an appearance of excitement amongst all hands on board the yacht was caused by their perceiving that the boat towing astern of the stranger was their own second gig. Arms were outstretched with pointing fingers. Someone shouted out a long sentence, of which not a word could be made out, and then the brig, having reached the western limit of the bank, began to move diagonally away, increasing her distance from the yacht, but bringing her stern gradually into view. The people aft, Lingard noticed, left their places and walked over to the taffrail so as to keep him longer in sight. When about a mile off the bank, and nearly in line with the stern of the yacht, the brig's topsails fluttered, and the yards came down slowly on the caps. The fore and aft canvas ran down, and for some time she floated quietly with folded wings upon the transparent sheet of water, under the radiant silence of the sky. Then her anchor went to the bottom with a rumbling noise resembling the roll of distant thunder. In a moment her head tended to the last puffs of the northerly airs, and the ensign at the peak stirred, unfurled itself slowly, collapsed, flew out again, and finally hung down straight and still, as if weighted with lead. "Dead calm, sir," said Shaw to Lingard. "Dead calm again. We got into this funny place in the nick of time, sir." They stood for a while side by side, looking round upon the coast and the sea. The brig had been brought up in the middle of a broad belt of clear water. To the north, rocky ledges showed in black and white lines upon the slight swell setting in from there. A small island stood out from the broken water like the square tower of some submerged building. It was about 2 miles distant from the brig. To the eastward, the coast was low, a coast of green forests fringed with dark mangroves. There was in its somber dullness a clearly defined opening, as if a small piece had been cut out with a sharp knife. The water in it shone like a patch of polished silver. Lingard pointed it out to Shaw. "This is the entrance to the place where we are going," he said. Shaw stared, round-eyed. "I thought you came here on account of this here yacht," he stammered, surprised. "Ah, the yacht," said Lingard, musingly, keeping his eyes on the break in the coast. The yachty stamped his foot suddenly. "I would give all I am worth and throw in a few days of life into the bargain, if I could get her off and away before tonight." He calmed down, and again stood gazing at the land. A little within the entrance from behind the wall of forests an invisible fire belched out steadily the black and heavy convolutions of thick smoke, which stood out high, like a twisted and shivering pillar against the clear blue of the sky. "We must stop that game, Mr. Shaw," said Lingard, abruptly.
"Yes, sir."
"What game?" asked Shaw, looking round in wonder.
"This smoke," said Lingard, impatiently.
"It's a signal."
"Certainly, sir, though I don't see how we can do it. It seems far inland."
"A signal for what, sir?"
"It was not meant for us," said Lingard in an unexpectedly savage tone. H here, Shaw, make them put a blank charge into that forecastle gun. Tell them to ram hard the wadding and grease the mouth. We want to make a good noise. If old Jorgensen hears it, that fire will be out before you have time to turn round twice. In a minute, Mr. Carter. The yacht's boat had come alongside as soon as the brig had been brought up, and Carter had been waiting to take Lingard on board the yacht. They both walked now to the gangway. Shaw, following his commander, stood by to take his last orders. Put all the boats in the water, Mr. Shaw, Lingard was saying, with one foot on the rail, ready to leave his ship, and mount the four-pounder swivel in the longboat's bow. Cast off the sea lashings of the guns, but don't run them out yet. Keep the topsails loose and the jib ready for setting. I may want the sails in a hurry. Now, Mr. Carter, I am ready for you. Shove off, boys, said Carter as soon as they were seated in the boat. S shove off, and give way for a last pull before you get a long rest. The men lay back on their oars, grunting. Their faces were drawn, gray and streaked with the dried salt sprays. They had the worried expression of men who had a long call made upon their endurance. Carter, heavy-eyed and dull, steered for the yacht's gangway. Lingard asked as they were crossing the brig's bows. Water enough alongside your craft, I suppose? Yes. 8 to 12 feet, answered Carter, hoarsely. Say, Captain, where's your show of cutthroats? Why, the sea is as empty as a church on a weekday. The booming report, nearly over his head, of the brig's 18-pounder interrupted him. A round puff of white vapor, spreading itself lazily, clung in fading shreds about the foreyard. Lingard, turning half round in the stern sheets, looked at the smoke on the shore. Carter remained silent, staring sleepily at the yacht they were approaching. Lingard kept watching the smoke so intensely that he almost forgot where he was, till Carter's voice pronouncing sharply at his ear the words, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.